Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, coming at you, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of dark energy. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, your designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. I'm very glad to be back with you once again. Feels like it's been 6 months since I was here in this chair. And, of course, a heck of a lot has transpired since my last visit with you. We are jam-packed tonight, and we'll be covering a lot of ground. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, one of the real-life CIA employees, operatives, who toiled in secrecy and obscurity out there at the now famous, infamous Area 51 military base. I didn't work on anything like flying saucers. Rather, he was part of the team or teams that developed, tested, and flew some equally amazing aircraft. His name is T.D. Barnes, and he and his colleagues are responsible for the U-2 spy plane, the A-12, the SR-71, machines that truly helped to win the Cold War and protected the lives of you and your family and millions of Americans, millions of people all over the world, and yet you knew little, if anything, about it. He and the others couldn't even talk about it, not even to their own spouses. Well, they can talk about it now, at least within some limits. TD will be making his first appearance on Coast to Coast, and I can tell you from knowing the guy for the last 6-7 years, he is chock full of cool stories from the world's best-known secret base. And I guess it's fair to say that secret's out of the bag, but I'm betting there are plenty more out there right now. TD Barnes will join me in this half hour, and I'll make sure we save some time for you to ask him a couple of questions as well. Then in hour two, we'll be talking to a man from tomorrow, literally. His name is Bill Chalker. He'll join us from the other side of the international dateline. Bill lives around Sydney, Australia, just outside of Sydney. So he'll be joining us from down under with, among other things, a chilling tale of an alien abduction case that has now led to DNA evidence taken from something that is not easily explained. Call it an alien. He's also been making forays into the Chinese UFO scene, been over on the continent there a couple of times. And as with everything else these days, the Chinese seem to be right in the thick of things. I mean, they've got millions of people who are active members in their UFO clubs. Basically, they have them in every city. And this is not, I have all the respect in the world for MUFON and that organization. But compared to the interest level in China, it's not a comparison. And lately, there have been some amazing reports of mass sightings over there. So Bill is going to give us the lowdown on what the real story is on those sightings and a whole lot of other stuff. The UFO scene in Australia, how American ufology is viewed from over here, hot cases that he's working on. He is a world-class scientist and investigator, and I know you're going to enjoy what he has to say. Okay, since the last time I was here, The new and improved Hubble telescope is back up and running, providing us with some stunning images from deep space. I'll tell you, doesn't that stuff knock your socks off, those photos? And let's see, the First Lady of Japan told reporters she'd taken a trip to Venus. She says that planet, that's the planet not the health spa. Miyuki Hatoyama says she took the trip on a triangular-shaped UFO and that Venus is very beautiful and quite green. Beautiful and green. And I'd say we should also suspect maybe just a tad hot, maybe hotter than Las Vegas during the summer, for sure. No disrespect meant to the First Lady of Japan, but I'm wondering if maybe she had a dream rather than an actual journey. Still, I think it's brave of her to even talk about it in public, and I hope she doesn't catch too much flack for it. Good news and bad news from NASA in recent days. This past week, NASA launched a crash and splash mission, if that's what you want to call it, sort of an attack on the moon. They fired up this special lunar sensing satellite, put it on an Atlas rocket, fired it toward the moon. It's up there taking a close look at the surface of the moon. And the news as of this weekend is that it looks like there's a strong evidence of water on the lunar surface, on the South Pole, in these deep craters, very cold up there, and maybe elsewhere. Water in the form of frozen ice, which What that means is it makes a manned mission to the moon, back to the moon, I should say, so much more doable since, you know, we wouldn't have to haul water along. Water's pretty heavy. It makes manned missions up there a lot more complicated, a lot more expensive. In early October, I guess just days from now, this craft is going to plummet down to the surface of the moon and crash on purpose. It's going to create this huge plume of dust that should be visible from the Earth. And then scientists here are going to be analyzing the stuff that gets kicked up in the cloud, and hopefully they'll be able to confirm the presence of water. Presumably, you know, they're going to be careful not to hit any moon men or those visiting aliens that are up on those hidden moon bases we always hear about. The bad news from NASA, though, is I guess it's hardly news at all. They keep teasing us year after year with the idea that we might go back to the moon and then go on to Mars. I'm thinking that timetable is now delayed again. 2028 at the earliest, more likely into the 2030s, NASA is now admitting. And I'm betting when 2028 rolls around, we'll all hear how the government can't afford a mission to the moon, so it'll be delayed again, you know, until such time when we can afford it. And I remember Johnny Mathis had an old song about that date, the 12th of Never, I think he called it. On the Coast to Coast website, I've been bombarding our webmaster Lex with all sorts of odd tidbits over the last several days, things I picked up here and there, some items about these NASA missions and objectives. Also, I sent him something that lists 50 questions about 9/11, questions that deserve answers. And there's another list, 10 lies the media are telling about swine flu. Is it only 10? Oh, and I found a weird science story about a new extrasolar planet that's been discovered. This one seems to defy the laws of physics as we know them, according to scientists, that is. It's 10 times the size of Jupiter, which is big. And it's too big and too close to its own sun for it to make sense. It shouldn't be in an orbit like that and be able to stay there, but there it is. Also, I asked Lex to post a couple of other stories I had found, UFO stories, the ones coming out of China, so you can take a look at them before our guest Bill Chalker joins us in the second hour to talk about a few of them. Supposedly millions of Chinese have witnessed some of these craft. There's video, photos. How legitimate are the cases, though? Hard to say at this point. We'll get Bill's take on it. One story not on the website is one that built up a little traction a few weeks ago. It's about reports of a Bob Lazar Hollywood movie. Did you see any of that? You all know about Lazar, his stories that I had sort of a role in long ago about Area 51, S4, alien spaceships, all that stuff. And you can believe it or don't believe it, doesn't matter to me. It's not a religion. It was a news story. The report that broke 2.5 weeks ago, though, is that Matt Damon, Hollywood superstar Matt Damon, wants to play the Lazar part. And he's hot to trot on this movie deal with a company called Curmudgeon Films, which is reportedly working with Lazar. So after this story broke in the Hollywood Reporter, I get hit with all these emails about whether it's true, who's going to play me in the movie, when will filming start? I learned a long time ago to take everything that comes out of Hollywood with a heaping pile, a mountain, a continent of salt. Essentially, everyone I've ever talked to in that town is full of crap. Let me rephrase that. Everyone in the movie business is full of crap, and you can't believe anything they say. I have no beef with everyone else who lives there, including, I'm sure, a lot of loyal Coast to Coast listeners. There has been interest in a Lazar movie over the years. We signed a deal. I mean, I was party to it long ago, the first time back in 1990, I think, with Columbia Pictures. They came to town and said, let's go. And then they were acquired by Sony, and it got put on the shelf. And then later, the project went to New Line Cinema, which has done some great movies over the years, and it bounced from director to director and script to script. And it was always something that got in the way, although they were always very enthusiastic. The movie was never made. And then there was a third project a year or so ago with an independent producer that went nowhere. And then a few months ago, this filmmaker from Curmudgeon Films contacted me, said he wants to make this movie. I put him in touch with Lazar. They've been talking about it. They have some sort of preliminary agreement, but I don't think it's a real solid deal. And the stuff about Matt Damon is maybe wishful thinking, certainly greatly exaggerated. I am sad to say, because I think it'd be pretty cool for Damon to play that part. Now, Matt Damon did have an interest at one time in writing the script for this movie, but not in playing Lazar, so far as I know. So there is some interest. This company is small, but it's very busy. Curmudgeon Films put out a movie this summer called My Sister's Keeper, which I guess I'm told did pretty well. So we'll just wait and see where it goes. And I promise to let you know if there are any meaningful developments. And yes, that would be a lot of fun to be involved in something like that, but I'm not holding my breath. And of course, there are many of these online knuckleheads who are out there. They're just out of their skulls that anyone would make a movie about Lazar. It drives them right up the wall for a variety of reasons. So I've been, how do you put it, chatting with them through various email exchanges that are not entirely or exactly cordial. Eat your heart out, fellas. We're taking a break, and in a moment, a guy who really did work at Area 51 and has the photos to prove it, and you can see them too. When we come back, T.D. Barnes and the Secret Plains of Groom Lake. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Knapp. We've talked about Area 51 a lot of times when I've hosted the program, and I am I'm pretty sure that the folks at Area 51, I've caused them a lot of headaches over the years because we did those initial stories about UFOs and all the Lazar allegations, and as a result, tens of thousands of people have gone out there in the into the desert and made pests of themselves. And there's been a lot of media out there even now, 20 years later, and congressional inquiries, things like that have probably interfered with the work out there. I'm sure I'm not a real popular guy, not with everyone. However, about 6, 7 years ago, I had the opportunity, the privilege of meeting T.D. Barnes, who works with who helps organize a group called the Roadrunners. It's an organization, sort of a fraternal organization, made up of all the guys who worked out there on the various projects. And slowly, over the last few years, they've been able to talk more and more about their work. The CIA sort of opened up a little bit, but it wasn't always that way. Anyway, I got to meet these guys, and I'm sure it's been shocking, TD, that you've squired me around at a couple of those meetings, even at your banquet, and introduced me to your colleagues, wouldn't you say?
Yes, it was. It's taken a long time, George, but you finally got me on here.
Hey, tell the folks what it was your job was. I know in your bio it says that you were recruited to Groom Lake, Nevada, as part of the most highly classified special projects team since the Manhattan Project, which of course was the atomic bomb project. What did you work on? What did you do?
Basically, I was pretty highly trained in mostly radars, electronics. I had worked on the X-15 project before going through Groom Lake, so I was working in hypersonic flight support, as you might say. We were putting men up in the fringes of outer space, and that was part of it. But mostly, I had a knowledge of just about every radar known to man, including the Soviet radars, and this was something that was attractive to the CIA. I'd worked with the CIA while I was in the Army. At an early age of my getting advanced into the radar field, and we were doing Project Palladium against evaluating the capabilities of the Soviet Union, and so anyway, that's what caught their eye. And then I was working on the NASA range, and they needed me for the project that they started out there on the MiGs.
You were a radar guy. You're working at other facilities in Nevada. You had an inkling that something funny, something interesting was going on out there. Anyway, before they recruited you, right?
Yeah, I knew they had something fast out there, and it came to light when they moved the YF-12 to Edwards. When Johnson announced that we had a Mark III plane, well, we rushed a couple of them down to Edwards so that the media could see them, and they stayed there, and they actually shared our control room. But the A-12, which was CIA, the YF-12 was there for us. The A-12, they didn't talk about that. No one really knew about it, but it got to the point where I would get a call on a special mission where they needed primarily a verifiable velocity, and this is a capability I had on my particular radar site because we used it for the X-15. I would get a call, and no one would be allowed in the radar room, and I would track the plane. They wouldn't tell me what it was, and then they'd pick up the data, and that was last I'd heard of it. So I knew pretty well what was going on out there.
Describe for me the level of secrecy when you got there. I mean, you didn't even know what you were working on, and as you may have heard me in the introduction, I said you couldn't even tell your spouse what you were doing. Is that, am I exaggerating?
Oh, no, that's true. We weren't able to actually tell our wives or even each other to a certain extent. There's some things we still can't talk about even among ourselves. But they just classified us. It'd be 2 years. Actually, it was September 19, 2007. It's the first time that we could freely, even talk to her wives or to other roadrunners about what we did.
And this is years after you've retired from working out there.
Oh, yeah, many, many years. Yeah, in fact, they shut that particular program in 1968, and virtually all of it's declassified. There is some aspects of some missions that are still classified, and that's probably because it would be embarrassing to tell some other country that we flew over them.
So when you hear people say secrets can't be kept, everything leaks out, you know better.
We know better. Yeah, yeah, it is. And there's still certain things, even when we get together, there are guys I worked with for years out there, and we played together out at the lake. Well, that's one thing we had in common. We all had boats on Lake Mead, and to this day, we still don't ask on certain things because we know it's still classified and that we don't have a need to know.
You had told me that you're in line. There's a cafeteria out there, everybody in the chow hall where everybody eats. You're in line. You could see a guy every day. You're next to him eating, and you had no idea what he did.
Yeah, the details. Now, you had a vague idea of what most of them did, what kind of project it's working on, but you didn't know the details, and you didn't ask. And it's just like the guys that's in my special projects team. We all worked on different things up there. Some might be working on the stealth, and others may, you know, I was working with the MiG program, that's declassified, and different things were going on, and we might need some help. So you'd holler at one of the guys, come and give me a hand with this. But he didn't ask you, you know, what, why are you doing it or what you doing? He would give you a hand. So you knew to a certain extent what was going on in a broad sense, but you just didn't ask any details.
And the work you did in secrecy and in obscurity protected the lives of millions of people, millions of Americans, people all over the world, and the rest of us had no idea what you were doing.
Oh, gosh, yeah. For example, the A-12, we flew 2,850 missions out of Groom Lake with the A-12. And before we went operational, we were still operating out of Groom Lake, but we actually had three of the planes sitting in Kadena, Okinawa, and that's where we would take off from. And what we were doing was flying over to North Vietnam and locating the SAM sites. They'd shoot at us. They couldn't hit us. We were too fast and too high. But what it did is it told the regular fighter pilots and whatever where they're at so they could avoid them. And the so we saved a lot of lives on that. And then on the MiG program, the kill ratio was roughly 9-1 against us in Vietnam. They were just really taking us to the cleaner. So we got our hands on first one was the MiG-21 in 1968. And we brought it out to the area. And, of course, we took it apart and see what made it tick. And then we started flying it. That was very educational, and then shortly after that, we got two MiG-17s, which was Korean War vintage, and we were evaluating them because we were still flying against them in Vietnam. And basically what we learned is it wasn't that the planes were superior. They just had certain situational environments where they were superior, you know, at a certain altitude or whatever. And what we learned, if you don't get him on the first try, don't go back. He's going to get you.
So basically, over the years, the CIA, by hook or by crook, acquired these MiGs, these advanced, for their time, MiGs, stuck them out at Groom Lake. You guys flew them against our stuff, and you ran the radar and figured out how to beat them.
Yeah, we evaluated them. We had just about every radar known to man. At the same time we got them, we got hold of some Soviet radar, which was one of my babies because we wanted to see what they were seeing with their own eyes. So we would use their radar to track what we was tracking out there. That just became part of the radar array. But the what we learned on it was, for example, the Navy, we had a lot of people involved in the program. It wasn't just CIA. You had the Foreign Technology Division out of Wright-Patterson. You had all your Tactical Air Command, and you had all your intelligence agencies. Everybody had a hand in this because they all needed to know what we were finding out. And totally reversed the kill ratio in Vietnam by what we learned there. And then what we did, too, another thing we learned is a fighter pilot in general it takes him 10 missions to learn how to really survive a combat. So what we came out of this is we started Red Flag, and the Navy did the Top Gun, and they would give their pilots that first 10 missions here in Nevada rather than against the real enemy.
Hey, TD, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want you to tell our audience about the Roadrunners, this organization that you helped found, and some of the amazing documents and photos that have been released that give people a real unique look into what life at Groom Lake was really like. So stay with us here, everyone. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast AM. Thanks for being with us, everyone, tonight on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with T.D. Barnes, a real-life CIA employee who worked at Groom Lake for a number of years on secret projects. Coming up, we're going to tell you about an event that's going to be happening here in Las Vegas, where T.D. and several of his colleagues from out there will meet and speak to the public about some of their adventures and the things they worked on in total secrecy. When we come back, I'll provide you the details on that. We'll pick up our conversation. Stay with us. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast. Welcome back. We're talking with T.D. Barnes, a veteran of the famous or infamous Area 51 military base here in Nevada. T.D., you know, 20 years ago when I started digging into this stuff, you'd ask questions about Area 51 or Groom Lake or whatever you want to call it at the time, and the government would not acknowledge it. Now, we both know that in the beginning there was a little tiny press release when they built it back in the 50s that said, hey, we're building something out here. And then somewhere along the line it went poof, and it wasn't on the maps anymore, and nobody would talk about it. They wouldn't even verify there was a base there. They wouldn't let you use the term Area 51. What changed? How is it that you and the Roadrunners are able to talk about it at least a little bit?
Yeah, this is kind of funny how this happened. When they started classifying some of the activities, they declassified the existence of our planes in 1991 when they started putting them in the museums. But the project itself was still heavily classified in the missions, and our names absolutely were not released until, like I said earlier, 2 years ago. And but it has changed to the point that now in October we're going to be having a two-day event in a DOE building, the Nevada Testing Museum here in Las Vegas. So 2 years ago, DOE couldn't even say the word Area 51. And yet today they're hosting our event. So it's been a learning process. I think a lot of us we've been in their face so much. And
you and the Roadrunners, and the Roadrunners, this organization of former employees, you guys have been pestering them, right? Hey, we want to talk about this.
Yeah, we started the oral history project for UNLV about 6 years ago. Even while part of it was still classified, they started realizing that our people are getting up in years, and they're going to lose all this history because no one knows. It's all in our heads. There's no CIA didn't know. They had the projects, but they didn't know what went on because when we had a meeting, there's no pencil or paper allowed in the room, that sort of thing. And so when the younger generations, when they started trying to record the history and legacy of this program, they realized that, man, we don't know anything. And fortunately, I had started the website, and slowly materials started coming in from different sources. And so now they're just as eager now to record the history of this because we accomplished a lot. And the agency's proud of it. The Air Force is proud of it. And to a certain extent, you know, it needs to be told.
You know, people like me would file these FOIA requests, Freedom of Information requests, and ask about Area 51 and any photos and names. And yeah. They just tell us to get lost. And then you started, you were basically the conduit for this stuff. When they wanted to release something, they released it through you, right?
Yeah, we established our credibility real quick with the, particularly with the agency, because that was the customer. And we started working on it. And then when they started declassifying stuff, they realized they didn't know very much, but they sit on our website, and they start contacting me on it. And as they started declassifying the documents back there, well, they would correlate with me, and then if they had a question for one of the pilots or one of the engineers, I knew who to reach out and get whatever information they needed. So we just kind of formed a team then as we did this, and we've developed a very strong friendship. And now the CIA wants to be a part of everything we do. In fact, at our reunion, the CIA will have the store set up in the museum for the general public to come in and buy all kinds of little CIA goodies.
Yeah, that's very cool. I've got piles of them.
I saw you last reunion. You're doing
I'm going to have to get a second job to pay for some of that stuff I'm buying. Okay, so your event, you're having your biannual reunion of the Roadrunners in Las Vegas in the first week in October there, or 5th through the 8th, I guess?
Yes, we'll be with the public the 7th and 8th. We'll have a symposium. In fact, you're going to be the moderator on the one on the 7th. We'll be there all day at the museum, but the panel itself won't start until I think it's 6 p.m. and be for about 2 hours. And it'll be a question and answer type arrangement, so we'll be answering their questions from the public.
We got a link on the Coast to Coast website. This event is happening at the Atomic Testing Museum here in Las Vegas. If you folks are within driving distance of Las Vegas and you want to talk to some guys who worked at Area 51 and hear their stories, come on out to the event. There's 2 days of that at the museum, and then the Roadrunners will be there, and then they're going to be having some fun on their own. TD, these planes that you worked on, I love the terms that you guys use. You talked about the CIA as being the customer, and then you talked about, I think somebody called the U-2 the item. Was that the term for it?
The U-2 and the A-12 both were called articles.
Articles, that's it.
The planes were called articles. The pilots were called drivers, and the camera was called the package.
And, you said, the CIA has come a long way. They're very proud of the work that was done out there, but there are still limits. They don't want to call it Area 51. They don't want to acknowledge that they were there, right?
No, that's the situation. I'm sure they would love to, but the once they ever did that, that would turn loose, all the lawyers and crazy people in the world would be suing for the secrets, and it would just open up a bucket of worms that they shouldn't have to deal with.
I know you don't, you're not real keen on the whole UFO scenario, but I got to ask you the question, and then we'll go to the phones. It's caused a lot of problems out there, I'm sure, all the people who would wander over the perimeter and staring into the sky about whatever to look for UFOs or whatever, but it interferes with missions and things of that sort. You never saw any of that. You never saw anything like a flying saucer in a hangar. You don't think it was out there?
No, there wasn't anything like that out there.
You're sure?
Yeah, I'm sure on that.
And what do you think about Papoose Lake?
When we were out there, there was absolutely nothing there in the 60s. And of course, I lived there in the early 70s, so what happened after that? But you wouldn't believe how primitive it was out there when we first started going out there. Because we'd fly out there on Monday morning and come home with Friday night. In fact, initially, we weren't even allowed to live in this state. We had to commute from another state to work each week.
And it was Spartan out there, right?
Yeah, we just little trailer houses, and it was stuff we borrowed from the Navy at Hawthorne. We hauled it in to put the planes in. It just really wasn't anything there.
Eventually, you got a bar, though.
Yeah, we got a bar. We had a little three-stooler there, and we had a swimming pool, of all things. Of course, it wasn't put there for the swimming. That was for us to train our people in flight suits and that sort of thing.
I've had a chance to meet some of your colleagues, the guys you worked with, the pilots, the mechanics, and guys. All of them are characters. I guess it had to be a special breed. I don't want to use the term right stuff because I know that rubs some people the wrong way, but it did take a special kind of a guy to take this job on and not be able to talk about it.
Exactly. The families themselves are so unique, and that's something I emphasize. Our group has been together for 50 years. Even the widows of the people, we lost 20% of our pilots, and the widows of those pilots and our engineers and different ones, they are still in daily contact with us. They come to every reunion. In most cases, you'd lose the wife would move off, get married, or whatever, and you lose track of them. But for 50 years, they're still part of the family. And another thing is, and this speaks for the selection that the CIA did, how good a job they did. But there's no divorces. We all were the original wives, and the stability of the family is just amazing, considering that we were gone five days a week for years.
Hey, T.D. Barnes, let's take a couple of calls. East of the Rockies, John in St. Louis. Hi, John.
How you doing, my friend?
Okay. What's on your mind?
And oddly enough, my nickname is Radar. But this goes back to 1978. Me and a buddy were up in La Grande, Oregon, and we used to go up to Lookout Point and just stargaze and have a couple beers. And one night we were watching, and we saw a light, bright light, which we thought was a shooting star, and it was tracking like one. Then all of a sudden, it banked about five or six hard right angles and disappeared. So what's flying up that way? Okay. What was that?
Okay, Radar, I'll tell you a little bit about the A-12. Of course, the U-2 couldn't go that fast, but the A-12 flew 2,200 miles an hour. That's faster than a rifle bullet. We never flew over any large cities, so talking about the UFO thing, the people have seen lights over the cities. That was not us. But we flew 2,850 missions out of Groom Lake, most of them at 80,000 feet at Mach 3. But talk about sharp turns. When we had to turn our plane around when we was at speed, took a minimum of 85 miles. Normal turning radius was 125 miles. So I don't know what you were seeing, but it wasn't us.
Well, tell me this, TD, as a follow-up to John's question there, though, I'm not asking you to spill the secrets, but, you know, we've heard speculation that there's all kinds of really exotic stuff out there, and maybe you know about it and maybe you don't, and you probably can't talk about it, but the projections that there's stuff out there that would make George Lucas drool, that it's 50 years beyond anything that the public knows about now. Without spilling the beans, I mean, is that sort of close to the picture?
Oh, yeah. There's no question in my mind that we got stuff that just we can't even imagine it. And you got to remember that the sight out there is, you just talking about how it, all of a sudden it disappeared from the maps and stuff. Well, what happened when they first started out there was just going to be the U-2 program, and that was it. And it just happened that Lockheed got the A-12 program, and since they already had the people on boots on the ground at the area, they said, well, let's do the A-12 out there. And so when we broke up in 68, you would have thought, you know, they'd locked the doors. But Lockheed, once again, got the stealth contract, the F-117s. And that's what kept the base growing. And then pretty soon other companies were realizing, you know, that's a neat place out there. They already got the mess hall. They got security. Maybe we can make a deal to go out and test what we're building, because a lot of the companies are building the proof of concept planes that they want to use to bid on a government contract. So that's a lot of what goes on out there. That's just a beautiful place for someone to come out and test, you know, build and test their own stuff to bid against your competitors.
Well, I mean, you know, we live in a dangerous world, and secrecy is necessary for you guys to develop stuff like that. But as you and I have spoken privately, I mean, and I don't know if you necessarily agree, but there's the potential for abuse out there when you live in a place that's not on the map and it is not accountable to anyone outside, and, you know, things can happen.
Yes, that's true. And and I don't know of any cases, but mostly it was pretty serious about work that went on out there. But in the modern times, as it got larger and stuff, you know, it's possible.
Well, it's indispensable now. The place is gigantic. It's huge. You know, they're always expanding it. I couldn't imagine, you know, we hear these stories, oh, yeah, Area 51 closed down. Baloney. I mean, yeah. You know, you couldn't replace it, could you?
No, and their things have been declassified in just recent years that went on while we was out there that, you know, I've said before there's times when they'd run us all in the mess hall and pull the blackout curtains and keep us in there 2 or 3 hours while something's going on outside that we did need to see. Well, what that would be, I'm not saying there's an exotic craft, but maybe they were landing a squadron of Chinese nationalists out there. We had a lot of other projects that going on where we were training people for covert operations, particularly in China and places. And And that's always, and they have declassified some of that. And the so we always had strangers out there. And but we didn't need to know this out there. So, you know, they'd lock us up until they got them hid and then let us back out.
So there it is. You guys have the highest security clearances basically of anyone. You've been screened and tested and prodded and cleared. And even then, after you've kept your mouth shut, you've kept your oaths, when certain things would happen, you had to be rounded up in a room and they'd lock and blacken out the windows.
Yeah, everything was on need to know. And even within our own circles, you didn't, like, for example, a pilot coming in from a sortie, another pilot wouldn't say, hey, what did you see today or how did it go? You just did not ask. He reported strictly to his CIA contact, and that was it. And we, as they declassified material, even the pilots learned a lot about each other that they had no idea, because you didn't talk shop.
That's amazing. West of the Rockies, Chip in southern Oregon. Hi, Chip.
Hey, gentlemen. Good evening. How's it going?
All right. What's on your mind?
All right. Well, I just want to ask Mr. Barnes if he ever run into any, maybe any extra-dimensional beings or possibly any Freemasonic rituals or possible possession behavior going on out there because of the world fully waking up to those secret societies and their blatant Lucifer worship?
No, we absolutely we didn't. And this is something that couldn't be kept secret. You know, you like to think that's a secret place and you got all this secret stuff going on. But just like I mentioned, you had transit people, foreigners coming in there for maybe a 3 to 6 week training program or something. And so, you know, stuff like that would keep you from being able to have a real highly secret project going that you couldn't control.
But, I mean, weren't the foreigners shielded from seeing everything that was out there?
Yeah, they were as well. So I'm sure that they landed there, and then where they went, you know, we had no idea. Because I remember one particular night when a C-130 landed out, and instead of stopping up at security, it actually landed up in the radar array. And I was working on a radar out there, and personally, I saw these guys marching by, and it's Chinese. And they were there for the they trained them to drop the flares across China to detect nuclear explosions, but they brought them out there to train them. But where they took them, I have no idea, because they weren't in the mess hall. We never saw them again.
Yeah, I know it's been a while since you've been there, but you keep contact, I mean, on an unofficial basis with what goes on out there?
To a certain extent, yeah. Sort of, yeah.
Do you hear stories about people violating the perimeter? I'm going to get into Area 51. I'm going to sneak in there and see what I can see. Or let's drive our recreational vehicle past the guards and see what happens.
Not too much. There, some people are kind of resented that the interference. They thought it took up too much time of the security and worrying about stuff going on out there. But it doesn't seem to be a real major concern.
And if you had if you could speak in generalities about what might be going on out there, just to make we taxpayer Americans feel better about what's being done with their dollars, what could you say? Is there anything you could say? Guess, just guess.
It'd be speculation, the trend, just the different things that's come out of there in recent years that they declassified, most of it's been unmanned vehicles, and I think that's the thing of the future. Is going to be the Predator and the Reaper is just the start, and they've actually released one or two more. Of course, the Global Hawk, it didn't fly there, but it'd be similar vehicles like that. And I imagine that those things are already obsolete, even though they're just now getting the flying.
And Area 51 would be the place where their successors are being developed.
I would say so, yes.
A lot of what you've dragged out of the CIA willingly or grudgingly are these photos. You know, in the shows that I've had to put together over the years, there's very few photos to use. But you've got some amazing ones on your website. We've got links to your website and also information about your event coming up. And wish you a lot of luck with it, TD. I'll be there to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Appreciate it.
All right. Coming up, we'll be talking with Bill Chalker from Down Under. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM.